Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations. This is part 2 of episode 13 on a 1959 paper by Donald Roy entitled Banana Time, Job Satisfaction and Informal Interaction. If you haven't listened to part 1 yet, please go and do so now, as this is a direct continuation of that discussion. In part 1, we looked a lot at group motivation and group dynamics, which we will continue in this part to some extent, but also go into much depth into the temporality aspect of this very interesting paper. Now, without further ado, back to the conversation.
So, I think I wanted to go back a bit to Taylor and, you know, the whole Industrial Revolution. Because actually the first thing when I read is that I remember that I read somewhere some time ago that factories and production context before the Industrial Revolution, they actually had music and singing was quite common. So there were, you know, multiple ways in which workers would find engagement. But, you know, after Taylor and the whole routinization and the whole nature of the machines that were much louder, you know, that cut out this kind of fun, if you want, and, you know, work became very standardized and the whole boredom thing came up. And when I was reading the text, you know, one thing that I felt, there's almost like this assumption that monotony is unavoidable in this kind of work that they are doing. But I was thinking, you can design a machine, you can design a work process in multiple ways, and you can design them for, you know, to need input for different people, so it becomes a more social thing, you know, two people working together, so they interact more. But so I don't think necessarily it's unavoidable, but it seems that the assumption it is there, you know. So I was wondering what you guys have to say about that.
Before we speculate on this, I do have to put it to the record that I want to resist the notion of designing something that is better outright, because I think one of the things that Roy's paper shows is that because the work was designed, it was monotonous, and any kind of design, I think, in any case, will be monotonous to someone. So I think one of the main takeaways from Roy here in the Banana Time is that it is the people themselves who will make it interesting through their emergent engagement with work rather than some particular design, and then that is supposed to entertain them in some way. But
here's another way to look at it. I think you're both right to some extent. I think that it is up to the workers to do what I would call humanize the work, that is not something that designers can really foresee per se. And so it depends on what your design criteria are that you're attempting to enact through your work design. And many times the designers aren't attempting to make it interesting for the workers, and therefore it's not one of their design criteria. But so that's why you could say it's possible, but I think it isn't even necessary. Roy is showing, as Dimitris points out, it's not necessary. Because the workers will find a way. They will identify things that they can make part of the work to make it more human for themselves. I mean, you'd like to have work that was sufficiently varied, interactive, that it made it more interesting. And the example I will give you is the way Toyota has implemented the assembly line process. It's done in teams, and there's cross training, and there's lots of extra work you get to do. It's not one person doing the same thing every single day. So they've actually designed that into the production process, but that isn't to say that the workers still don't find other ways to interact or make the work less monotonous. And in fact, a big part of the Toyota production system is also their approach to problem solving that does bring forth creativity and the workers' intellect and experience. So they, in some respects, they've designed it into their work through the processes that they use.
Ralph actually read my mind, because I was going to contrapose Dimitri's point with the idea of Toyota, because I don't know if it should go so much into contemporary organizational theory, but Paul Adler has written exactly about Toyota, and he makes a case that Toyota is specifically designed in a way to be, he calls it enabling for workers, but you can say that's for, it's more enriching and everything, you know. I disagree in part with him, because I think that in part, so I think I agree with Dimitri in the extent that when you design something, when people use it, you know, it's the usability that actually adds new dimensions. But you can at least make an effort to make it, you know, more interesting, if anything. You know, it, my point is that at this moment, it seems that, you know, it was almost designed to be monotonous. Or at least it didn't, as Ralph said, even think about that. That could be a problem.
I think as Ralph pointed out in part one, is that it was simply not designed with the human element in mind. It was the production process that you have inputs of material and effort. They interact according to a process. And then you have production outputs. And there you go. So this goes here. They do that. And you have a thing that we sell. I think, and this is kind of very reminiscent of Taylorism and this the early management and production stuff. So I think in that way, if you look at it this way, so okay, mm-hmm. you have the inputs, you have the agents, and you have the outputs, and so how can we make the working conditions for the agents more sort of motivating? I think if you approach it that way, from this sort of systemic angle, then what I said applies. But if you look at it, you know, with the humans from the get-go, that, okay, so we need to achieve these objectives, so what are the ways that the workers can be constrained or enabled here or there, and why they should be constrained or enabled in these circumstances, then, you know, that's a different thing. And that is the modern incarnation of Taylorism, which is the lean manufacturing that you keep alluding to, but what I was referring to mm-hmm. was more that this thing that, okay, so let's make it fun for them, and we're going to do it through A, B, and C, and here, there, and, you know, over there. I think it's this may be a perceptual difference between the two.
Mm. Okay, sorry, I was being unjust to you. But when you said that, it just made me realize that, you know, I can't really remember where I read it, but there was like this case that seems very, you know, old, was actually contemporary, of a factory in China in which there was like many cases of suicides and very low morale. And people were puzzled because, you know, the company tried to, you know, they had like swimming pools and gyms and like whatever, and like places that, you know, like school for the kids inside the factory, and like
is
any
it Foxconn
kind of, you know, like,
that you speak of,
niceties that you can imagine.
Yeah, Foxconn.
But maybe yes, so you know better the case than I do, so maybe you can.
Wasn't it the case that they simply didn't have the opportunity to use any of that stuff? Was that the case?
Was
it might be a different case or a different angle, so I guess maybe carry on with what you were saying.
No, if I understood it correctly, I think that's exactly the misperception of the thing. You know, if you are just, you know, adding something on the side instead of focusing on how in the work itself we could think with the human as the center of the whole process.
Yes, you know? And I think that's one of the things that Foxconn learned, was that these other things were external to the work and they didn't seem to make a difference in the stress that people felt, and that was in the nature of the work they were doing. So they had to rethink the work. Mm-hmm. The cases I've read don't go into a lot of detail about that, but they said they had to do a lot of things to restructure the way the work was done to reduce the pressure on the workers to meet production goals and quotas and those sorts of things.
I read just recently that I guess the culmination of this effort was that they replaced a huge chunk of workforce with automated equipment.
Wow.
I think that was about Foxconn. I mean, we may be all over the place.
Yeah,
so,
I can believe that.
You know, don't quote us on that, I suppose. But if it does hold, then this is a different way to do, you know. So, okay, it doesn't work out with plugging people into the equation. So let's get mm-hmm. rid of that altogether and automate the workplace in as much as possible. Of course, it wasn't as much of an option in Roy's day, but certainly is now and will be.
Well, and another example of work redesign is something you probably doesn't bear much resemblance to manufacturing as described in Banana Time. But there's been recent reports lately that the turnover rate in investment banking is very high because they're subjecting mm-hmm. the workers to high stress. And Pedro, you probably heard about this in New York. They're subjecting the workers to high stress, long hours mm-hmm. of drudgery and research that the workers don't find interesting. And a large number of the workers leave before they put in even 5 years. And that is devastating to the investment banking industry or work type of work, because you're not getting people the experience that you need. So companies like Goldman Sachs and others have been looking at how can they redesign the work. I mean, I'm not saying they're successful at it, but they are recognizing that it's something they have to pay more attention to, because the modern equivalent is the turnover. Because back in Roy's day, okay, you could get more people to go do this and you could just burn them out. But now there's an actual shortage of the workers for the jobs that need to be done, and you can't afford to have that kind of turnover.
That is interesting, I think, because it brings the other dimension of emotions, if you want, that we go from monotony to stress. Because I think that's the difference here. In Goldman Sachs, it's probably more about the stress you're subject to, not so that you are bored.
Well, but in the investment banking case, some of it's stress, but also some of it is just monotonous work with long hours and many weekends, and that's burning people out. And unlike in the times that Roy is writing about in Taylor's time, when workers might not have had a lot of options, these people who are at the investment bank have many options, and so they leave the workforce, and the companies know that that's a problem for them.
It's actually a similar case with management consulting, that the shelf life of a typical consultant is about 3 years.
Yes.
Shelf life.
That's not my coinage. That is actually how it was put to me by a consultant. Yeah.
I know.
But that reflects a very interesting attitude towards your workers.
That's horrible.
Yeah.
Their longevity
exactly.
Shelf
very
life.
Tayloristic.
Yes.
Well, it's very much it's very congruent to what we're reading, that you have the resource view of the firm, which is that you quantify and inventorize what you have, people included, and then you apply some sort of scientific management that is perhaps devout of Taylor's ideological striving to improve the lives of workers, whichever way he went around doing that. And there you go, you have the time spans, so you have the temporal dimension that is also covered here of how long before the consultant would likely to expire, as it were. So it's very much still alive, this stuff that we're covering, that the beginnings of management that perhaps wasn't the most human-friendly way of organizing labor.
So I have a question, because we've kind of been talking about, or we've kind of centered all the discussion on the management side, but so this idea of designing and making the workplace with certain characteristics, so on and so forth. But my question is also, what kind of employees contribute to making the workplace in this way? Because I think that the employees that Roy is talking about are pretty special as employees, because I'm sure that there are many people that associate the idea of work with something serious, the idea of professionalism with something, a serious attitude. And I think if people were to think about the idea of playing at the workplace, playing games and so on, they would see it as something that they shouldn't do. So what do you think about this side of the story?
I suppose, at least, I guess to answer part of your questions, that every single workplace that I've been part of had element of play eventually. And I think the case with the Roy's description is that it may not necessarily be that people are special, although he does mention that they all used to be employed in a more higher level jobs, if you will, before the war, and then they're there by force of circumstance rather than by own volition. But I think the thing there is that they're just bored silly. So the work is so monotonous and so meaningless. Maybe that's more important here, that they found it meaningless to punch holes in that stuff, that they are so cognitively numb that they just play is the one of the basic instincts that kicks in to maintain some kind of level of sanity.
But are you sure that this is one of the main instincts? Because I think that one of the main instincts today could be to quit your job.
I don't think so, because quitting job is quite a radical,
or looking for something else.
Well, wait after, you know, move. So it's a major disruption. But playing games is primal. You know, animals do it, kids do it. You mentioned it yourself. It's a way of.
I don't want to go into the whole. Sorry, Dimitris.
No, it's fine.
I interrupt you because I really couldn't resist going to the whole primal biological thing, especially nowadays that, you know, people in business schools are trying to study humans by studying chimpanzees, which I find very debatable, to say the least. But I think that in a way...
I'm not advocating that, but I guess my question is, have you ever worked anywhere that was devout of any kind of play?
That's my point. And that's what I think I disagree with Miranda a bit, is that... because I have, I think, an interesting case to share. So in the ethnography I did, the organization that I have been part of, I think there is place is always part. Even though it's a different kind of play, might not be as physical as this one here, but it can be just like telling jokes. Even though they might be disrespectful jokes, but they still are there, you know? And if I remember correctly, I read some time ago the book by Michel Crozier, which is about bureaucracy, and he goes on to study like two public organizations in France. And one of them, it's I think somewhere in Paris, and they're doing kind of like data processing thing, old school, you know, like reading documents. And like, in a way, the workplace was very serious. And that exactly was the problem. That is, in part because people were not very, they didn't take a lot of pride in the work that they did. And they didn't interact outside work. They didn't like even have lunch together. People would like tend to have lunch with other people outside in like in the city with other friends. It lacked that kind of informal bonding or just kind of sharedness that you have, like that's important, the informal aspects of organization. And that made the organization very, you know, like, I want to say, hefty and unresponsive. And every time they had to do something, everyone disagreed and no one could get together and didn't know what to say. So actually it was a case that in which play was not so present, created a lot of problems.
So they lacked social cohesion is what it sounds like?
Yeah, pretty much.
Right. Well, play is one of the things that play does. It's an expression of imagination and creativity. So emerging in such structured and drudging, as you put it, places of work, is. I think it only shows, really, that play is very important and quite... you don't want me to use the word basic, but... something like that for
fundamental.
Sure, it's quite fundamental to the human human conduct. And you know, consider the case of the opposite. So we talked about a very serious, let's say, boring organizations, if you will, and you have people playing as a matter of personal initiative. What about organizations that encourage that? You know, like Google and such, where they actually overload you with opportunities to play. So does the opposite happen? Is it that you no longer need to have this release valve of your personal creativity and imagination and your inner self because it's everywhere? So do you actually do more serious work? Is that you know, is that the rationale behind that? Why would you offer your employees? You know, if you think like Taylor, right? You want highest amount of waste reduction.
Yeah.
So sticking a ping pong table, those sleeping meditation eggs to encourage employees to nap at work, you know, that would be completely mind-blowing for Taylor. So allowing all these distractions, if you will, that is nonsensical. That's absurd for scientific management. But here we are. We have it. It's one of the largest, one of the most successful organizations at the moment. And it works. They're not slacking off all day, presumably.
Well, I'm going to contest Google. But before I do that, because it's one of my personal, I would say, pet peeves, is to deconstruct all this love for Google. But before I do that, I was just going to say that even like simple organizations, for instance, I know that the Art Center at Warwick, when they hire people to work, you know, all kinds of admin stuff, or especially like they have to send a lot of invitations, I think, for people to become members of the Art Center, whatever. They let people bring their own iPods and whatever, like music. So you can listen to your music and like work in the post office or do anything, or listen to music while you're waiting someone to show up and like buy a ticket. So I think that organizations, as you were saying, Dimitri, got much, I don't want to say better, but they changed this Tayloristic idea and realized it's actually something that contributes to the efficiency if you let people know have a bit of fun or break down the monotony of the work in a way. But
that's what Roy says.
Yes. But I think that it became like a conscious thing, because I remember I saw like a job description application and they said that, you know, you are allowed to bring your music, which is something that, you know, this was almost like emergent in Roy time. You know, management was not aware or not encouraging that. And now we have something that is more, you know, official, if you want.
Yes, you must bring your own music. But that's the whole thing about what Roy writes, that he was tired, but when they were playing, they didn't feel it. So if you're engaged in, you know, as a holistic individual, you know, you are more productive. If you enjoy what you do, you will want to do more of it and better and improve things.
Having said that, you know, when we were talking before about this idea of it's different to change the work process and to add niceties on the site, and we spoke about Foxconn and this whole idea that whether you design the work in a more human-centered way or you just, you know, don't consider the human aspect, but somehow let space for people, you know, to do their own thing. I think if you, I don't know if you agree with me, but in a way, the whole deal with Google of having cake for people and ping pong things and your own laundry, it doesn't really goes into, you know, a different kind of work process, because I pretty much expect software engineers there to do what they do in Intel or any or like other, you know, big company. It's just that they have these niceties on the side.
Okay, so what's your point?
My point is that Google is actually not that revolutionary. It's actually, it really feels that they read this paper and said, okay, let's give some like cool stuff for people to do on the side of their job, but doesn't really entail a different way of doing
work. That may be so, but I mean, they are possibly the most colorful ones. So, you know, a good example by virtue of that. Let's say, so we had an empty room and we put a bunch of people there and said, you need to achieve A, B, and C. I guess the question is, would that have been so terribly wrong compared to if you put them in a room that has a number of machines that are specifically designed to accomplish specific tasks, you know, in very constrained ways, and said you need to do A, B, and C, and here is a huge manual that you need to follow. So I think that may be the kind of crux of the matter here. And, you know, the two are extremes, and we're probably looking for a golden mean in any case, but is it that you need to tell people what to do, which is the kind of more structural scientific perspectives, or do you trust people to be clever enough to come up with a process you may not necessarily agree with altogether, but if it still gets the job done, you know, what's the difference? I think that might be one of the discussions here that's relevant. My experience with this comes from teaching. So you have two ways of doing things. Well, you have a whole range of doing things, but the two ends of the continuum are either here, read this paper, and I'm going to ask you these five questions and you must discuss and, you know, touch upon points A, B, and C, which always goes terribly wrong and everyone's bored and you look at a class and you can't force anyone to participate. At least I don't know of a way that you would be able to.
Mm-hmm.
And you have 25, 30 people just staring at you or at the floor, and if you ask someone, you just go silent. What can you do? You have no ideas about answering the question for some boring paper that your tutor gave you. It's only so much that can happen. Or you do these very ad hoc, very open-ended projects where you put some people together and say that, okay, so you need to accomplish this. In whichever way you want, there is no wrong way, you know, as long as you don't do something haphazardly and have a reason for it. And it's very different. It's stressful at first, but then they get a huge sense of reward and accomplishment.
Well, I think both of you are talking about the need for people to find ways to contribute not just their skills and fingertips and dexterity and that sort of thing, but you're both talking about how people can bring their creativity to bear in the work they do. And I think it was interesting that Roy makes a distinction between two types of communication. So it's instrumental and consumatory, right? And so you could also look at it as work design, right? So there's instrumental work design, which is sort of the Taylor approach. And then there's this consumatory communication aspect or work design where it's interaction for its own sake. And it's not just mere social engagement, but this connectivity amongst the workers that brings job satisfaction. And Roy suggests possibly, he doesn't really have enough data to back it up, better job endurance, at least in his case, because he didn't feel the fatigue as much with his interaction. So I think you guys are both making good points.
Shall we talk about temporality a bit?
Oh, yes, please. Yeah.
Because one of the things that, you know, banana time sure. is a dual thing. On one hand, it's a way to deal with group dynamics, but on the other hand, it's the, you know, the actual reference to a time when that one person would steal a banana from the other, wave it around and eat it.
Maybe try giving an explanation of temporality, what you mean by it.
Mm-hmm.
So temporality is normally just a reference to an experience of time. So in this case, you had banana time, which is a more unstructured, more lived experience of time, right? So Roy mentions that banana time occurred usually following peach time, and each of those different fruit times occurred roughly once an hour. So, you know, there's this interval of every hour. At some point, they have a fruit time, banana time, a peach time, kiwi time, whatever. That's how they, if you will, experience time that is meaningful, because in between that you have just this monotonous punching of holes in things that they don't really care for, and then they wait for something to play this game. It's that kind of thing. And the significance of that for time is primarily such that there are traditionally two views on time, a linear and a lived time. And linear time is very Newtonian. It's what we have. It's essentially the clock. It goes from the past, which is a spent resource, through to the present, which is the work process, and into the future, which is a, you know, strategy, if you will, kind of putting time into management speak. Lived time, on the other hand, it brings both the past and the future into the present. So it's the experience of being in the now, where a certain experience of the past do shape your perceptions of what the future may be like. So for instance, in Roy's case, after he accidentally broke the social dynamics with his insensitive joke, you know, that would hypothetically, it's not in the article, but that would hypothetically inform his what he would do in the future should the opportunity to innovate in this way arise again. He might not go for it, for instance. So that's the lived time. And banana time, it's quite fascinating, especially for theory and temporality, because it's so phenomenological, right? They are all, again, isolated in this space, and I think they have some windows, but, you know, even if they didn't, it makes no difference. They work these 12, 13, 14-hour shifts. It's pretty much, you know, they're there all the time. So whether it's noon or 1 o'clock or 3 or 5, it doesn't really matter. They still do the same thing. That's the clock time, and that's how it's manifest. It's very management in that you need to produce this many units per hour, right? So you make this much work per minute, and you have the time and motion studies that you mentioned before, Pedro. But it's completely meaningless to them. And Roy says so repeatedly that no one cares for that, and that he even wrote in his journal that how on earth is this organization still in business, because we're so unconnected with the products of our labor that no one really cares too much to do anything above minimum, which was also a problem that Taylor faced. If you recall that, how to motivate people to work as hard in a factory as they do on a cricket field after work. He was completely puzzled by that.
Yes, that was a problem for
him. Yeah, and this is one thing, because they think, from management perspective, from planning, time as a resource, that it's defined bits and pieces that form, you know, 60 minutes an hour, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And you need to use that with maximum efficiency in order to be economical. That's what economics is, really. Just making the most with what you've got. Banana time, on the other hand, it's brilliant because it demonstrates that for these people, time was an event.
Yes, it punctuates their workday.
I see.
Yes.
Yeah, the measurement of time for them, or rather the experience of time for them, was not done against the hand of the clock. It was done against an event when someone would steal a fruit, right?
Yeah.
So the past and the future put together in one, not even a duration, but actual event that is distinctive, that is different from banana time yesterday, and banana time tomorrow will be different yet again, especially if someone doesn't bring a banana. So, you know, those are these unique dispersed markers, if you will, that show to them the progression of themselves and of kind of time throughout the day. So that's the big thing in this paper about temporality and time. And it shows that if you're grunting on the shop floor, as these people were, clock is, you know, it can't have punitive power, like punching the clock. And if you're late, you know, you get sanctioned. But really, in an environment of monotony and sameness, the experience of time is the banana time. It's very phenomenological. And if you don't have an opportunity to form some kind of some events with which to produce time, as it were, produce continuity, then I don't know. I mean, Groy says that that is not a possibility because people come up with stuff to do to make their work fun. But, you know, hypothetically, if you could completely remove all waste, including temporal waste, then that would probably be the killing off of humanity altogether. So this is, in part, being a human means being so forming a deep unity of past, present, and future, and you know, even transcending these categories. So it's very intrinsic to the human consciousness, and we as people, we cannot not experience time.
I remember that one of the things that was, I would say, unexpected but fun about my ethnography, my research, was that one of my main informants said about the company, you know, on a given Friday, that as we entered an office, said, "Oh, you can really know that it's Friday just by the smell of the breakfast on the air." Because, like, traditionally, all the engineer teams would, you know, order or bring cookies or savory stuff or sweet stuff, just eat together on a Friday, you know, kind of celebrate, you know, the end of the week and socialize, kind of casual Friday, but foodie Friday way. So that brings me to an interesting thing, though. So what you're trying to say that, in a way, Taylor and all the whole management literature think of time in a very clock time way, you know, the traditional.
Right.
Yeah. I remember that, like, there are probably Greek words for those distinctions, but I can't remember which one goes where. One is Chronos, the other Kairos, right? So very clock time like. Well, whereas work, when it's accomplished, actually is lived through a different dimension, which is the more and more, you know, like this lived experience of time, which has a different face.
Yes.
So my question is, so could management, I would say, use that, take advantage, you know, like, kind of, you know, use, like, imagine if the management of this company read this paper and they knew that, okay, so for the worker, the really thing that matters is, like, this all kind of, like, different events that happen throughout the day. So could we do something different? That could that be managed in a way?
Yes, yes, of course. I mean, what you said about cookies on Friday, you know, it's not cookies on Friday, because Friday is just yet another sequence on the timescale. It's cookies on the day that is before when we get off work. So that's the significance of Friday, right?
Yeah.
Friday itself doesn't mean anything if it wasn't followed by Saturday, which just happens to be a day off. That is the event, that is the banana time of your organization. And things like, you know, casual Fridays, or I don't know, I haven't had much experience of these wacky organizational practices where they introduce these specific things to do on specific days or even specific times. But that is like that, right? I mean, management time, linear time, it's only used by management insofar as it is very convenient for planning.
Okay.
If you know that you have so many days a year and so much resources to produce this many things, You can spread it out and you can plan. You can't do that with live time because live time is by its own intrinsic nature, it has to mean something. So it would be different for different people. You know, you can have a banana time transpiring, but one person is sitting and just not getting it. And it means nothing. And they just think that people are wasting time, but their own version would be different. But to answer your question, yeah, definitely. Initiatives to, especially in the more monotonous workspaces where the lived experience of time is perhaps not as rich as it would be doing something that's more connected with, you know, own aspirations, that entrepreneurial work or science, whatever, things that people are interested in.
I was expecting that you would say no, because when I read this paper, and especially considering the whole event of Black Friday, is that I was thinking of all the efforts of management to try to, you know, manage or nurture or promote kind of, you know, social relations, such as community of practices or trying to manage culture, which are things that are, in a way, emergent out of the dynamics between workers. But, you know, organizations try to, like, get your hands on somehow. You know, and the event of Black Friday showed that, you know, a joke or the expansion of a joke badly done kind of made the whole, like, social structure collapse.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, the thing is that managers are still people who experience time in the same way as the employees do. So I think if not thinking as a manager of your organization as a system, you know, maybe the first step towards recognizing that, hey, there's more to work than planning and keeping to schedule. So that's why I didn't say no, because we're not managed. It's not the, you know, the dystopian future where we're managed by the machines. It's not the Matrix. People are managed by people, largely. So why not? Why wouldn't they experience time in the same banana time kind of way? The thing with linear time is that if you're in a position where you are responsible for work and you have a degree of authority and power, it's extremely comforting because you can write things out well into the future and you buy yourself time in the future because, you know, you planned things to happen there. It's on a personal level, it's almost like ensuring that, you know, I will still be alive 2 years from now when we finish this project because, you know, I'm the project lead and this is when I'm going to deliver a presentation. It's very comforting and it's easy and you can see the whole thing. You have the Gantt charts that show progression through time and, you know, lines that intersect and connect with each other.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was, I think Ralph would be able to help me out. Was it Eisenhower who said that plans are important, but nothing ever goes according to plan?
Right. So one version of that is no plan survives first contact with the enemy. That's number one. And what Eisenhower said is plans are nothing, but planning is everything. So essentially, right, yes. It's the process of planning. And you see the same stuff in high reliability, right? It's not that you are going to get a particular result. It's talking about and understanding what goes to produce the result. That's where you get all the benefit from planning.
Yeah, that's true. Because no organization is ever going to be structured around live time. That is not even anarchy. That is just nonsense. But no organization simultaneously is ever going to be structured and survive, structured purely around linear time. So it's about recognizing the other being live time, and incorporating that into, you know, it's the same discussion about ensuring that the people are actually people and not mechanisms, and incorporating that into the work process, except the time is intangible, so it's more difficult to get your head around it and especially to kind of implement that into the workplace in a meaningful way. So
I said it before, so maybe it's irrelevant, but if boredom and monotony is still present, are we living the age of stress? You know, because I was trying to think through different kind of jobs, you know, from high end ones to, you know, working class ones. And I don't know, like being a telemarketing person or a McDonald's employee, I'm sure there is monotony there, but there is also stress or just like one or the other, or the case of the, Ralph brought of the investment bankers. Is it all, you know, we have the problem of keeping people in the job, but it's like, it's because they're stressed out, because they're working long hours and they feel bored.
Well, I would say my understanding from the research that's been done and also the descriptions, it's some of all of that, right? So some of it's just the long hours. Some of it's the nature of the monotonous work. That's why you see a lot of burnout in junior lawyers, because they basically have a certain amount of dues they have to pay for monotonous research work and behind the scenes briefs for the cases that go on, that many people just can't get over that and don't find it rewarding and therefore want to move on and do different kinds of work. So I think that is it is the case.
Okay, so monotony is still something in the knowledge economy. So that's the point.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, okay. I mean, McDonald's is, you know, while it's in the knowledge economy by virtue of, you know, temporal coexistence, it's not a knowledge organization. So it's not the Schumpeterian, okay, you know, cycle that suddenly everyone gets just upgraded to the knowledge economy. You know, you still got really agrarian and, you know, industrial revolution-esque organizations around, quite a lot of them.
So what about knowledge work, like typical knowledge work that would agree that, you know, it's part of this new way, it's not knowledge intensive, you know, do you think there is still boredom there?
Well, I can say two things. One, to be a good co-host is yes. The other, to be an academic, to say, what do you mean by knowledge work?
Professional work, let's put it like engineers, lawyers, I don't know, surgeons, doctors, no, let's make it easier.
Yeah, I mean, why not?
Professionals.
You know, knowledge work never, I don't think knowledge work was ever supposed to mean that it's creative and, you know, intellectually enriching work. It's just transferring the locus of production from the body into, you know, the cognition, I think.
My takeaway is monotony is here to stay. Thank God we managed not to learn a lot about it by reading this classic.
Yes, I think it is important for managers to understand that that social connectivity amongst the workers and some way to bring individuality and maybe gamesmanship or some way to be some form of entertainment is very important. You have to allow space for that, and some organizations do. I've heard about organizations. Demetrius was talking about the casual Fridays as a way to make things more interesting or give people more options in the way of dress. And I've also heard of other organizations where they'll either, it might be on a Wednesday or they might be on a Friday, but after the end of the workday or maybe even the last hour of the workday, they clean up the shop or the office and then they have a party or the cake for somebody's birthday. In fact, I've been in organizations that do that regularly. Or they bring in a keg of beer or beers and people relax and socialize. And so they're trying to bring that into the work environment. And I think what Roy is showing us here that managers could benefit from is that all work has to have that. If managers don't bring it in either in work design, as you were calling for, Pedro, or providing these opportunities for it, they'll do it themselves.
Yes, that's what's going to be my takeaway is that I think it's less about necessarily enabling or structuring this stuff into work, but more about removing restrictions that prevent people to do what they would do anyway.
Because yes,
that's what they
creating do. Creating the
space. And there's definitely the role of games.
Yes.
Which is kind of like present in all of your takeaways, but the importance, the different roles that games can play also in the workplace.
And that's all for episode 13. Thank you for listening so much. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and if you have, please share it with your friends, colleagues, and students. And if you get a minute, leave us a review on iTunes or wherever else you may be listening. These are very helpful for new listeners to find us. Next week, we are going to release a summary for this episode. And next time, so in a week, we are going to be joined by Henry Mintzberg to discuss his 2013 book Simply Managing. This is all terribly exciting and we're very much looking forward to bringing you that episode. But for now, please have fun reflecting on the fascinating things highlighted by Donald F. Roy in this amazing paper entitled Banana Time, here on Talking About Organizations.